From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
This is what popular uprising looks like.
Protests over corruption and unemployment were sparked after a man set himself on fire.
You might remember the song from the 1970s that said, "The revolution will not be televised." More modern lyrics might read, "The revolution will be tweeted."
Amid the protests in Tunisia, there has been much talk about the activity of Tunisians online and the role that new media are playing in the uprising. Some have called it a WikiLeaks revolution, attributing the unrest to leaked diplomatic cables about corruption in the Tunisian government. Others have called it a Twitter revolution because of all the social media activities surrounding the protests. But political scientist and foreign policy blogger Mark Lynch has assiduously studied the Arab press and says it's not so simple. He says the internet, social media, and Al Jazeera have collectively transformed the information environment in the Arab world. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been following the evolving Arab media landscape for the last decade. What's the big change in that time?
Well, there have been two big changes. One, of course, was the rise of Al Jazeera and satellite television. That had the effect of really making it very difficult for Arab governments to control the flow of information. And the next big change has been the rise of mass participation in social media, which has really increased the ability of individual citizens to circumvent all efforts to control the media. A remarkable portion of the Tunisian population is on Facebook, for instance. YouTube was extremely important as a repository for these user-generated videos. All of it together, the combination of what's on the new media and what's on Al Jazeera, you can almost think of it as this massive signaling device. In the absence of the media coverage, people in one part of Tunisia might not have known what was happening in another part of Tunisia. In a sense, you almost have to see the images of other people braving the military, going out in the streets, before it even occurs to you to say, you know, I could do that too. And then, once it's on Al Jazeera, there's this very strong sense of the whole Arab world is watching us. That gives them moral support, encouragement, and you get this kind of feedback effect.
So give me a kind of scenario how, say, a single cell phone could lead to a huge report on Al Jazeera.
So the way it might work is you've had people watching a demonstration on Al Jazeera. They're inspired by it. They get a group of their friends that they coordinate over SMS. They all come together. They use their mobile phone to shoot a video of themselves demonstrating. They upload it through Twitter or YouTube or something like that. That then becomes a focal point for more protests, and the coverage follows it. You've got lots of people all with their phones, shooting images of it, tweeting about it, writing about it on their Facebook page, which creates images for newspapers, videos that can be used on the air, even if you don't have a single journalist on the ground.
In your blog posting, you said that Al Jazeera didn't just spread information, that it facilitated the framing of events and a robust public debate about their meaning. It seemed like Al Jazeera's coverage was cheering the Tunisians on. It was a different role from straight news gathering, wasn't it?
They see themselves as the voice of the Arab street, of the Arab people. It's not actually obvious that what happens in Tunisia should be relevant to a Jordanian or to a Yemeni. Yet the way Al Jazeera frames it, it naturally fits. This is a common struggle of Arab peoples against oppressive regimes. And when people are talking about Tunisia, it's not just Tunisians. It's Egyptians, Moroccans, Jordanians, Palestinians, Saudis. It really doesn't matter because they're framing it as part of this very broad Arab public struggle.
Do they apply the appropriate amount of skepticism to reports that they get from Twitter and Facebook from people they don't know?
I think that they face the same problems that a lot of Western journalists face in trying to assess the credibility of events when it's moving extremely fast and, crucially, when the government is still clamping down on all ordinary sources. And so, in a sense, they're trying to pick out the truth from this chaotic information environment.
Can you distinguish then between how, say, Al Jazeera used Facebook and Twitter and how Western news outlets did?
I think it's similar, except that Al Jazeera and other satellite TV stations in the Arab world simply cared a lot more. In the United States, Tunisia wasn't a story that anybody really cared about. When people in the United States talk about Arab democracy, pretty much all they talk about is Egypt. And so the fact that you had a democratic revolution going on in Tunisia didn't register on their radar as something that mattered.
Why wasn't the Tunisian government more effective in blocking the new media, as Iran did during its so-called Twitter revolution?
There's no question that they tried. They had, I would say, state-of-the-art censorship and repression capabilities. They tried to interfere with new media sites. They tried putting kind of false flag people on there to spread disruptive messages. They tried to arrest people when they could find prominent figures who were using new media. They would arrest them, try to make an example of them. I think that, though, they simply got caught up in the flow of events, and they just weren't able to adapt as quickly as they had expected.
So how come this revolution succeeded and the one in Iran didn't?
One thing which you have to acknowledge is that in Iran, you had an evenly divided society. The Green Movement represented a significant portion of the population, but there also was real support for the regime on the other side. And in Tunisia, the military took itself out of the game in large part. And if there was support for the ruling regime, it didn't really manifest itself.
So fundamentally, the lesson here is that you need the media, but it can't work in a vacuum.
I think that if people try and make the media the cause, calling this a Twitter revolution or an Al Jazeera revolution, it kind of misses the point. That's the background. That's the system in which people operate. But the revolution was made by people. Tunisians getting out in the streets, taking personal risks, working towards a common goal, who were able to use this environment to do some genuinely new things.
Mark, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke.
Mark Lynch teaches at George Washington University and blogs at foreignpolicy.com. Several bloggers and online activists were imprisoned during the protests this month, normal practice in a country rife with censorship. 22-year-old Tunisian rapper Hamada Ben Amour, also known as The General, was arrested because of a viral video of his song called President, Your People Are Dying. The General has since been released from prison along with numerous bloggers as the wave of protests forced the government to ease its restrictions. This makes it easier for Lina Benmeni to run her blog, A Tunisian Girl, which until now has been banned in her own country. She also had her Facebook and email hijacked by the government earlier this month. Recently, she's put her safety on the line, filling her blog with scenes from the streets of the dead and the dying. Lina, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
During the protests, what sources have Tunisians primarily relied on to get their information? Is everyone looking for news on Facebook and Twitter?
Yes, Twitter and Facebook played a big and important role in the spread of the information. The two first weeks, foreign media was following everything on Facebook and Twitter. Starting from 2 weeks ago, they started to come to Tunisia to cover the events.
Do you worry that there is a problem when foreign media rely on such sources as Facebook and Twitter because people can so easily make things up?
We didn't spread information without linking it to videos and pictures showing that this really happened.
What about government hijacking sites and using it to spread misinformation?
They started hijacking and hacking websites. But it wasn't to spread misinformation, but indeed it was to try to dissuade people who were covering the events. For example, I discovered that my email and my Facebook page had been hijacked, but they didn't use them to spread misinformation. They just shut them down.
Have you personally had any direct contact with the Tunisian police?
They are following me every day, so yes.
Have they spoken to you?
Yes, they were trying to harass me verbally. For example, this is very funny. One day I was going out to buy some coffee, and they just wanted to provoke me. So one looked to the other, to police officer, and said, look, this is Lina. She was in the United States, and she's got AIDS.
They said you had AIDS?
Yes. Just to bother me, to drive me crazy, but I never talk to them. I never answer them.
Are you experiencing then a sense of freedom now that didn't exist before the protests began earlier this month?
Yes. Now journalists are working more freely. For example, now journalists can take pictures easily in the streets, and even the official medias are now interviewing dissidents, and all the people are invited to speak on Tunisian TVs, on radio stations.
Even you?
Even me, yes.
What about your blog and your Twitter account and Facebook? Are they no longer censored?
No, they are no longer censored. There is no censorship anymore.
So, Lina, for most of the time you've been blogging, it's really mostly foreigners or Tunisians living abroad who have had access to your blog. Now you can blog for Tunisians inside Tunisia. How does that feel?
I was looking at the statistics of my blog, of the audience for my blog. I see that there are more and more Tunisians who are reading the blog, and this makes me happy.
What do you want to tell them first of all?
Okay, I'm proud to be Tunisian, and I'm proud that Tunisian citizens succeeded in their revolution.
Lina, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Tunisian blogger and linguistics teacher, Lina Ben Meni.
Coming up, what do you do when the FBI tells you under penalty of law to keep your mouth shut? One guy told everybody.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A few weeks ago, Twitter took a bold stand and won the right to disclose to a few users, users purportedly connected to WikiLeaks, that their accounts were the subject of a Justice Department subpoena. It was a rare example of an online communications company breaking the silence that's imposed when, as in this case, it comes with a gag order. When the government, in the course of investigating a crime, wants to ferret out information online, it can choose either of two kinds of subpoenas. The first requires a judge's approval and may include a gag order. Companies can appeal the gag order, like Twitter successfully did, and alert their users that the feds are on their trail, but few do. The second kind of subpoena is more severe and is used in cases that involve national security. It's called a national security letter, and until recently, it imposed mandatory, unending silence on whoever received one. Both kinds of subpoenas are so useful that they're being used these days at an unprecedented rate. Nobody knows exactly how many regular subpoenas are issued, but ISPs are starting to cry uncle because they can't keep up. Meanwhile, the federal government itself estimated that they are serving 50,000 national security letters every year.
In the last few years, legal challenges have at least chipped away at the secrecy that accompanies the national security letter, allowing an appeal before a judge. And so far, out of the hundreds of thousands of national security letters served, a whopping three organizations have won the right to just say they got one. Jamil Jaffer at the American Civil Liberties Union has challenged the national security letters in court. He says that winning even three people the ability to speak through the gag of silence is progress.
The FBI can still issue these national security letters, but it used to be that there was secrecy in every single case and that it was virtually impossible for anyone who received one of these things to challenge the requirement that they not talk about the letter. That's changed. When ISPs challenge the non-disclosure orders in court, courts now give real, meaningful scrutiny to the FBI's claim that secrecy is necessary. Now, to say that it's possible for an ISP to do that is not the same thing as saying that ISPs actually do it.
Now, in a moment, we're going to speak with Nicholas Merrill, who was, in fact, the proprietor of the ISP to which you referred and the first to challenge the government on this issue. But what puzzles me is why, if these provisions in the original Patriot Act and the subsequent tweaks of it were declared unconstitutional by federal courts, why thousands and thousands and thousands of national security letter recipients haven't materialized to talk about their experiences.
Nick is one of three. The other national security letter cases that have gone public involved librarians in Connecticut. And then there was another NSL served on the Internet Archive. But I think it's reasonable to ask why more ISPs aren't coming forward and challenging either the non-disclosure order or the FBI's demand for information. And I think that the answer to that, or at least a partial answer to that, is that the ISPs don't often have an interest in asserting their subscribers' rights. It's not the ISP's information that's at stake, and none of the subscribers ever know that the FBI has asked the ISPs for information. And so the ISPs have really very little incentive to come forward and take on the government.
Although, as we've seen, some of these large corporations are beginning to rethink the issue because they are so inundated with government requests for data about their clients that it's becoming time-consuming simply for them to comply. 10 and 20 national security letters or subpoenas per day coming into companies like Google?
I think that's right. Many of these large corporations, these large internet service providers, are rethinking their privacy policies, and that's in part because of the volume of the demands that the FBI is serving on them. I think it's also in part because they are increasingly recognizing that customers are picking their online service providers in part on the basis of privacy policies. Now, I think that that is changing very slowly, and obviously privacy is only one of many, many factors that customers or prospective customers take into account. And I think as individuals become more aware of the way that their information is being collected and stored and analyzed and retained and disseminated, what you'll see is a shift in consumer behavior.
One company that's pushed back is Twitter, which is not an internet service provider, but obviously does all of its business online. What is it doing to fight the government on indiscriminate issuances of subpoenas?
Well, basically what Twitter is doing is notifying the people whose privacy rights are at stake. Initially, there was a non-disclosure order, but ultimately the non-disclosure order was lifted. As a result, Twitter's users have the ability now to go to court and challenge the government's demand if they want to. And that's a very important thing because ultimately we all now entrust so much information to third parties. And if those third parties hand over our information without ever informing us that the government has demanded the information, then we lose control not only over the information, but all of the aspects of our lives that come with that information.
Now, when the government overreaches, it's very easy to summon outrage, but it's equally easy to forget that behind all of this, at least, is the government's genuine interest in national security and preventing crime, especially terrorism, for example. And I wonder what effect this kind of transparency will have on cases when there, you know, are real live terrorists conspiring to commit a real live act of mass murder, and Twitter or an ISP or somebody else notifies the subjects that the government is on the trail.
I think it's a totally legitimate concern. The problem, though, is that the statute now allows the FBI to use national security letters not only to gather information about suspected terrorists and criminals, but to gather information about anyone at all, so long as, in the FBI's view, the information is relevant to an ongoing investigation. That's the difference between a targeted investigatory tool and what we have now, which is a tool that the FBI can use to go essentially on fishing expeditions and gather information about people who are one or two or three or more degrees removed from the target of any actual investigation. And I think that's part of the reason why the FBI issues so many of these national security letters every year.
Jamil, thank you so much.
Thank you.
ACLU attorney Jamil Jaffer. National security letters are, by their nature, secret, like really, really, really secret. That's why only three people have ever won the right to disclose that they've received one. The first was a San Francisco nonprofit called, fittingly enough, the Internet Archive. The second was a local public library, and the third was a fellow named Nicholas Merrill, the founder of a small Internet service provider in New York City. Actually, Merrill was the first to bring a case, but the last to win. He was forced into silence for more than 6 years, and only in August was he legally allowed to do interviews like this one. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So paint me a picture here. I mean, is this like a Candygram or like a Law and Order episode deal where someone says your name in a locker room or something, and you turn around and he throws you an envelope and says, "You've been served"?
It was a little more formal than that. I was at my office. It was 2004, and I got a telephone call. The caller told me that they were with the FBI and that someone would be coming by my office with a letter for me. I wasn't really sure whether to believe it, but soon enough, I found out that it wasn't a joke when an actual agent did arrive at my office and handed me an envelope. Inside, there was a three-page letter. You can actually view it at aclu.org/NSL. And basically, the letter ordered me to produce information about one of the clients of my ISP.
And what do you do next?
What I did right at that very moment was simply read the letter. You know, a number of things leapt out at me. The first thing was a completely absolute commandment that I was never to tell anyone that I had received this letter or that I had been asked for information.
Not even your lawyer?
The letter said, tell no person. Your reaction just now was very close to my reaction. I looked at the agent and I said, not even my lawyer, not even my business partners. And the agent didn't really give me a clear answer, just kind of shrugged.
All right, so what happened next?
The agent left. I tried to make sense of it all. It made some obscure reference to part of the federal code, which I looked up, but if you've ever looked at the federal code, it's not so easy for a layman to read. But I know a bit about the law, and one of the first things that I was looking for was a judge's signature or which court this supposed subpoena had come from, and there was none. So I called my attorney, my feeling being I'm an American and I can always talk to an attorney and no one can tell me that I can't. He was a bit taken aback, and coincidentally, one of the clients of my internet service provider was the New York branch of the ACLU. So we got in touch with them.
So not only are you not telling anybody, now you're telling everybody. You go to the ACLU with your lawyer, and they advise you what?
They told me they had never seen one before. And at that point, I knew that this was really, really serious, and I started to wonder what had I gotten myself into.
Did you comply with the other parts of the order to turn over the information to the FBI that they were seeking?
No, I never did.
And the court ruled in your favor, but not entirely. What was the gist of its decision?
It was the first time anyone had ever challenged any of the powers from the USA Patriot Act. The court ruled two separate times that the national security letters provision is unconstitutional and a violation of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment.
Before we get to the current legal disposition of your national security letter, let's talk about the government's concerns. You know, there is a rational argument for such a legal tool. Let's say one of your internet clients at the time was a terrorist. Obviously, you would not want to tip such a person off that the feds were on the trail. So, you know, if not a secret subpoena, What is the solution?
It seems to me that the existing tools, such as normal subpoenas from a judge, are workable. Numerous terrorism plots have been broken up using those types of tools. If we don't have checks and balances, then we're really, I think, going down a dangerous path. And the purpose of having a judge listen to the evidence from law enforcement is to provide a check on their power.
Okay, so back to your disposition. You ultimately won the right to disclose that you had received this letter, but you didn't win the right to disclose everything. And in fact, even as we speak, you are holding in your lap a laptop with a 6-page single-spaced checklist of things you are or are not allowed to say lest you wind up in Leavenworth. How ungagged are you at this point?
The way I try to explain it to people is that if before I was partially released from the gag, there were 100 things I couldn't talk about, right now there's probably 97 things that I can't talk about. The main things that I won the right to say are that I was the plaintiff in this case and that I received a national security letter.
Now, the thing about your gag order is that it's in perpetuity. And you didn't sign up for this. I mean, it's not like you are a CIA officer understanding full well that some secrets had to be taken to the grave. You're an internet service provider who made no such bargain. What in the world is it like?
It has been a challenge, particularly during the 6 years when I couldn't say anything. I couldn't tell my family. I couldn't tell my fiance. I couldn't tell any of my colleagues. I couldn't speak to my elected representatives about what I felt was abuse of the law. Basically, it forced me to sometimes even lie to people. It put a wall between me and my clients where I couldn't be fully honest with them. That, on a professional ethics level, was a real problem for me. Now that I can at least say that I was the plaintiff in this case, it is somewhat of a relief. But at the same time, it just kind of opens up all kinds of situations where people ask me things that I can't answer. And it essentially just is a whole new set of problems. I mean, I've been warned that I should be really careful what I say because anything I say is probably being listened to, particularly public statements. I respect that even within the privacy of my own home and all my relationships because it's a huge risk.
It turns out that you're kind of a poster child for a very large group of people, the 50,000 or so each year who are served national security letters. Do you feel a burden of responsibility that you're speaking for this gigantic cohort of the gagged?
Between 2003 and 2006, around 200,000 of these letters went out. That works out to be nearly one letter per 1,000 Americans. Although you're allowed to challenge the gag every year now under the new revised law, the last time I did it, the government presented secret evidence that only they and the judge could see, and my attorneys could not see and therefore could not challenge. It does kind of add up to a lot of responsibility, and that's part of what motivated me to start my nonprofit organization, the Calix Institute. Part of it is to defend people who are gagged. Part of it is also to promote best practices among telecommunications companies in regards to the privacy of customer data.
Nick, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Nicholas Merrill is the founder of the Calix Internet Access Corporation and now director of the nonprofit Calix Institute.
And now an update on our Blow the Whistle project. A couple of weeks ago, we asked you to call your senators and ask them if he or she was the lone senator to put an anonymous hold on the important Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act in the waning hours of the 111th Congress. Thanks to your participation, On the Media has received confirmation from 43 senators that they were not responsible for the secret hold. Great progress, but we still have a ways to go. If you go to wnyc.org/ /blowthewhistle, you'll find information on how to contact your senator and instructions from the Government Accountability Project on what to say. Take down the name of the person you talk to and email us at blowthewhistle@wnyc.org with their response. We'll update our website with your data, and with luck, we'll figure out who quietly killed the bill that the whole Congress publicly says it wants.
And finally, a note about our friend and contributor John Solomon, who died recently after a long struggle with leukemia. After filing two pieces for OTM about Homeland Security back in 2004, John made emergency preparedness his life's work. This month, at a graduation ceremony for 122 new members of the Community Emergency Response Team, Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced the creation of the John D. Solomon Emergency Preparedness Award, which will be presented annually to a team member who shows, quote, outstanding dedication to the program and who embodies John Solomon's enthusiasm for volunteerism and purposeful engagement to make their communities better prepared for emergencies.
Coming up, how bad sources lead to bad reporting. And the Comcast deal really is a big deal.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, offering tools to manage, monitor, and measure social media. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. The N.E.E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care. On the web at aecf.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Comcast got good news this week. Federal regulators gave it the go-ahead to buy NBC Universal. Comcast, already the nation's largest cable TV provider and largest internet service provider, will now become the first cable company to own a major broadcast TV network. NBC's 30 Rock has been having a field day.
The only thing I will be discussing with the House Subcommittee on Baseball, Quiz Shows, Terrorism, and Media is vertical integration.
What's vertical integration?
Imagine that your favorite corn chip manufacturer also owned the number one diarrhea medication.
That'd be great, because then they could put a little sample of the medicine in each bag.
Keep thinking.
Except then they might be tempted to make the corn chips give you...
vertical integration.
Susan Crawford, who served as the president's special assistant for science, technology, and innovation policy in 2009, says the stakes of the Comcast deal are incredibly high. But it's so complicated, you might not realize it.
This deal has more angles than a marathon trick billiards match. But the key thing to understand is that Comcast can use this very popular content to make it difficult for any competing pay TV provider to show up. You mentioned in the lead-up that this is about Comcast buying a broadcast network. That's not actually the core of the deal. The core of this deal is about the cable channels that NBCU controls. USA is the number one cable channel the last 4 out of 5 years. CNBC is huge. The concern from people is that Comcast will use its power over that content to make it very difficult for competitors to emerge.
How can they use the popular cable channels they now owe a majority stake in to prevent these other competitors coming online?
Well, it's going to be very easy for Comcast to raise their rivals' prices. It's important to keep in mind that what's going on here is one owner for one pipe in many metropolitan areas. That gives that single actor unparalleled control over media, over internet access, over content, over our entire information ecosystem.
Obviously, the countervailing power is competition. And your argument is that there won't be any.
That's not only my argument. That's the FCC's argument. They said back in March that more than 75% of Americans will have only one choice for their high-speed internet access provider. Cable is in the lead, and they're ready to reap the rewards.
Where's the phone companies? Where's Verizon?
Verizon has to actually dig up the streets and put in fiber in order to compete with cable. The upgrade path for the phone company is much more expensive than it is for cable. Cable can just swap out electronics and upgrade its systems. Verizon announced back in March that it was backing off. So right now, 90% of people who are buying high-speed internet access services from their local company are getting it from the cable guys, not from the phone companies.
What about serving underserved communities with high-speed broadband access? This was something you said this deal would hobble, but actually FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski said that the government's approval of the deal was structured to increase broadband adoption in these underserved communities and also to increase local news coverage. These are two consistent problems confronting our new media world, so that's a benefit, right?
Absolutely. And I give the FCC credit for acknowledging that the cable industry had already made plans to expand its high-speed internet access to poorer households. As part of the deal, Comcast has voluntarily undertaken to serve 2.5 million households with high-speed internet at less than $10 a month for a limited period, not forever, and to make sure that devices that cost less than $150 are available to those households. There's also, as you say, a very interesting element of this deal that will pair up broadcast stations with nonprofit news gathering associations in local communities to make sure that there's somebody watching City Hall. That's fascinating. We'll see how that plays out.
But despite those clear benefits, you still feel that this is a net loss for the American people. You make the case that new communications technology have always had government regulation to help them get off the ground, to help nurture them in the early phase, and that online video is not getting the benefit of that kind of historical head start.
This is a very old story. We had to help the cable industry along initially. We then had to help the satellite industry. It takes government intervention to create the kind of Darwinian competition that makes communication so interesting. Right now, we're facing a grinding monopoly of a single pipe to many communities. These big pipes are so expensive to install that it really doesn't make sense to have more than one. And so in the history of communications policy, we've usually required that that kind of infrastructure be shared. That makes it possible for competition to emerge. We're not seeing that with the cable industry. Comcast has unmatched and unconstrained control. I'm hoping that Americans wake up as they did with the railroad monopoly and Standard Oil in the beginning of the 20th century. This is the same kind of situation, except now it's about news and information and entertainment and, in fact, our communications modality for everything we do.
All right. Susan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Susan Crawford is a law professor at Cardozo Law School. She blogs at scrawford.net, and she's working on a book about this very merger called The Big Squeeze.
This week in California, there was a gunfire incident.
According to Twitter feeds, shots have apparently been fired at Gardena High School in Los Angeles.
We know, Megan, there are three students who have been shot. This is confirmed by the Gardena police. This is
maybe another student that was being held hostage in that classroom.
The original report stated three Gardena High School students had been shot in a classroom. A few minutes later came the news that the shooter was 18 years old. A subsequent report said the gunman apparently had taken hostages. Within 90 minutes of the original newsflash, police announced that they had arrested a 17-year-old student who had come to school with a loaded gun in his backpack. When he tossed that bag onto his desk, the gun discharged once, and that bullet hit two classmates. Not three classmates, two. No hostage situation, no shooter, for that matter. So what was gained by such news organizations as CNN, KTLA-TV in Los Angeles, and USA Today to have been way out in front with the wrong information? It is that very question that faced NPR a week earlier when, amid the chaos of the Tucson shootings, it falsely reported the death of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords.
In a fast-changing news situation with conflicting reports, we should have been more cautious. NPR News apologizes to the family of Representative Giffords and to you, our listeners. We deeply regret our error.
The network has been raked over the coals for violating its own guidelines and basic journalistic standards in the episode. Among the harshest critics was NPR's own Scott Simon, Giffords' friend, who called the error reprehensible. On January 9th, NPR executive editor of news Dick Meyer apologized for the mistake. Dick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, how did it happen? What's the timeline?
We got information from the local sheriff's office that the congresswoman had been shot and killed. Another source in a member of Congress office confirmed the same information. That was two sources. It wasn't two appropriate sources, two perfect sources. It was two sources that were wrong. And the team that was putting together that newscast went with it. One of the most consequential missteps in process that happened was that our procedure mandates that for reporting that kind of information, a senior editor should have been brought into the discussion. On something as crucial as a life and death announcement, you need more than two sources. You need absolute authority.
Did you face the question, why is it so important for NPR or any other news organization, for that matter, to be the first with information that it just doesn't have absolutely nailed down? What's the rush?
It's a great question, and I think it's a relatively easy one for NPR to answer, which is there is no rush. To be absolutely first is not a primary value in a situation like this for NPR. It's much, much more important for us to be accurate and to be responsible. This was a very out-of-character mistake for NPR to make.
You weren't under the pressure of these 24-hour cable channels that are trying to advance a story in real time, live on the air, without any real new confirmed information coming in. So it was all the more shocking that NPR went on the air with something that was not confirmed, at least at the level of the hospital staff or the family.
Your word choice of shocking that we'd made a mistake, I think, is hyperbolic, Bob. I think anybody who looks at NPR's track record sees that it's about as good as it gets in broadcast news or print news.
Well, maybe that's why it was so shocking. What I wonder about is whether in this age of the 24-hour news cycle, NPR was or is beginning to find itself feeling the competitive pressure to be first.
I don't think we're at risk, just because we made this mistake, of having our internal barometer changed. Now, we are at risk of being under siege from much more information than ever before. It makes it harder to report stories, and it makes the consequences of reporting errors graver because they multiply instantaneously. So we made this error, and then it was picked up by social media, and it was instant viral. And I think this is going to have the effect of making us ever more cautious.
NPR has been in the news lately because of the Juan Williams fiasco, because of the resignation of senior VP for news Ellen Weiss in the wake of the Williams episode, and all sorts of noise on Capitol Hill, once again, about defunding public broadcasting. From a political point of view, could an episode like this have possibly come at a worse time?
There's no good time to make a serious mistake with reporting on the air. I mean, is this a rough period? Yeah. Will this mistake have enduring consequences for the defunding battle or anything else? No. I mean, we made a mistake. We took responsibility for it. I don't think it's going to be held against us. I think people appreciate our candor, but it's definitely a rough time for NPR.
One of the things we've learned from this incident was about the false security of apparently official reports. One of the sources for your reporter was a sheriff's deputy. I guess there's many a reporter would say, he's wearing a uniform, he's investigating the case, that's good enough for me. What are you doing to remind your staff that a badge does not necessarily confer omniscience?
We generally have a 2 or 3 source rule, but you have to look at the quality of the sources, whether they're really in a position to have firsthand definitive knowledge of what they're talking about. It's a lot of judgment calls, and there are no automatics. 2 wrong sources who are official doesn't do you any good.
Okay, Dick, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dick Meyer is executive editor of NPR News.
It's perilous to rely on official sources. Like all sources, they have their own motives for imparting information. When that's all the information a reporter has, the results can be tragic. Consider what happened on July 27, 1996, during the Summer Olympics in Atlanta.
Well, here in Atlanta, joy and celebration quickly turned to fear and death after an explosion in the Olympic Centennial Park early this morning. Authorities say it was a crude pipe bomb.
Richard Jewell, working as a private security guard, found the bomb, alerted the police, and helped evacuate the area, likely saving some lives. He then became a suspect, ridiculed and humiliated by the media. When he was cleared, he sued a number of news outlets and collected a fair piece of change. But it was clear from his interview with 60 Minutes' Mike Wallace that his nightmare had never really ended.
I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Wallace. There's 6-7 people in this room with us right now.
Yeah.
And I don't care what they say now. That first week, everybody in this room thought I was the bomber.
Jewell is the poster child for what happens when journalists fly into the ozone with law enforcement's wind under their wings. But he has a lot of competition.
I devote the best time of my life to this country to make this country stronger. But suddenly they told me I'm a traitor.
Taiwanese-American scientist Wen-Ho Lee was working at the Los Alamos National Laboratory when he was accused of stealing nuclear secrets for China. He was fired in March of 1999. News outlets led by the New York Times published a slew of incriminating stories. Lee was arrested and held in solitary confinement for 9 months. Eventually, 58 of the 59 charges against him were dropped. He sued news outlets and the government, and won. And then came the age of terror. More suspects, more suspicious leaks.
What the government and the media jointly did to Stephen Hatfill is a disgrace.
For a while, Stephen Hatfill, an expert in biowarfare, was the FBI's suspect of choice for the 2001 anthrax attacks. Salon's Glenn Greenwald told us in 2008, after biodefense researcher Bruce Ivins killed himself as he was about to be charged with the crime, that Hatfill's earlier persecution by the press, orchestrated by a series of FBI leaks, was utterly unjustified.
They did things like alert ABC News ahead of time when they searched his apartment wearing bioweapon suits. All along, there was zero evidence linking Stephen Hatfill to the anthrax attacks. It was a lynch mob that was achieved through anonymous leaks, which journalists then uncritically reported until the country was convinced that he was the killer.
Journalist Ronald Kessler has long covered the FBI.
The purpose of these leaks is to try to shake up the suspect and see what he'll do and see if more evidence can be obtained that way. It's almost unheard of for FBI investigations to be leaked, you know, with some exceptions. And the fact that this is happening, I think, indicates that there is this motive involved.
I find, having been on both sides of this fence, that there is no shared sense of responsibility here.
John Miller is a former ABC News reporter. When we spoke to him in 2008, he was assistant director for public affairs at the FBI.
There is intensive criticism, ironically, by the media for so-called government leaks, especially in cases where individuals later turn out to be perhaps not the right subject of the investigation. Yet it is the same media that put pressure on people, try to pull information out of them, then publish it, and then seem to be shocked and turn to blame the government.
But the stakes can be higher than the destruction of a single man's reputation. Bad information from officials can smear an entire city. Here's New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin in the midst of Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
There are people standing out there, have been in that freaking Superdome for 5 days, watching dead bodies, watching hooligans killing people, raping people.
The stakes can even be higher than that. Yellowcake uranium from Niger, aluminum tubes for centrifuges, hidden biological weapons labs in the Iraqi desert. All sanctioned leaks or official statements, all policy-driven, all wrong, formed the pretext for going to war. And it has been forever thus.
My fellow Americans, as President and Commander-in-Chief, it is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
The Gulf of Tonkin, epically bad official information. It's exactly like bad food. sometimes deliberately poisoned, sometimes spoiled by accident or happenstance. And it should be treated like food, with some knowledge of its provenance and nutritional value, consumed only after judicious prodding and a good long sniff. Because you need it to live, but the bad stuff can kill you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with more help from Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gallietti, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.